Welcome to Computer Vision. Today's topic is the epipolar geometry. We will first look at a simple stereo system, see how this works, and then in order to solve a couple of problems underway, we look at the epipolar constraint, the 8-point algorithm that is related to the epipolar constraint, and another method that is useful for model fitting that is called RANSEC. Okay, so how does stereo vision work? In theory and with the appropriate assumptions, it's not difficult. So we have pictures. We have two pictures showing the same object, or at least with significant overlap of the scenes, and the same object is seen with a certain offset from the optical center from each of the two cameras. And from the difference in these offsets, we can triangulate depth. Okay, that's all. Depth is the Z coordinate here. So a little bit more formal. So let's assume a simple case where both cameras are parallel. And Mark Stamminger will then talk about non-parallel cameras. Non-parallel cameras are also not a significant complication, but it requires an additional step, processing step, to rectify them. Okay, we're not going to talk about rectification. We just look at the geometric properties. So let's assume we have two parallel cameras. And our joint object that we're looking at is the point P. So then we have these two offsets, XL and XR, from the optical center of the camera. And what we can use is the intercept theorem on this triangle. So this is the depth Z. This is the baseline, essentially, between the two cameras. And this here is our focal length. And we can, for example, say so T plus XL minus XR is the red line here. So the red line relates to Z minus F is this line here, relates to Z minus F, like T, so the baseline here, to Z. Yeah. So this is just a direct application of the intercept theorem. And then we can rearrange things and say, okay, the depth Z equals F, our focal length, times the baseline T divided by the difference in these two offsets. So this difference in the two offsets is called disparity. Yeah. So we just triangulate depth and that's it. So there we are. Okay. So we can say problem solved. From a mathematical perspective, it's not a big deal, right? But there are a number of practical issues that need to be addressed because, for example, how do we know that we are looking at the same point, like that we're really observing the same point in these two cameras? Maybe we're confusing points because maybe there are many similar looking points in the picture. No? So we have to take care of that. I will come to this in a second. So to kind of list the subproblems that we have to solve in order to apply this comparably simple math for computing depth is So problem number one is how can we determine the relation of the two cameras to each other? So this essentially is the calibration problem. And second, how can we find a matching point X? So identify identical points in both pictures. So for example, so here's just an illustration, but you don't see anything, I guess, because the contrast here is really poor. I can see something, but I'm just 1 meter away from that. So if you have a point here and you take and you look at the same point here with some offset, then you can compute it to compute some depth value here. And what you could see in theory here, if you download the slides, you will see it, is a resulting depth image here. So the point X prime, Y prime is X plus disparity of X, Y, and Y. So this is the assumption that both cameras are parallel, are at the same height. So then we don't have a height offset here, but just a lateral shift. So this situation is fairly convenient because then we only need to look for corresponding points along one dimension, so along one line. And it turns out that the epipolar constraint provides a constraint where also for different like alignments of the cameras to each other, we still only have to search along a single line to find corresponding points. So, good. So, if we aim for calibrating the two cameras, what are the quantities that need to be recovered? So, one is we have the intrinsic parameters. The other thing is we have the extrinsic parameters. So, intrinsic parameters were the pixel size ratio, the camera center, focal length. the extrinsic parameters were the positions of the camera with respect to the world coordinates. And what we typically do is that we say, okay, let's try to align these cameras with our world coordinate system as much as possible. So for example, camera one is at position 0, 0, 0, and it looks along one of our axes and so on. No? And camera two is just like offset in X direction in world coordinates from that camera one. In that case, we only need to know that baseline T, if the cameras are parallel. If we have a slightly more general case, then okay, we certainly need rotation and translation between the cameras to know their relationship. Okay, and then of course we need correspondences for the pixels between the two cameras. Okay, good. So let me jump. Okay. So what the epipolar geometry provides is a constraint in the 2D image to the search for corresponding points to a 1D line. So this is a significant reduction in complexity, also in potentially confusing situations. And that is what makes it so useful. So here's a picture. We will have this picture on a number of slides today. But here's a picture that illustrates the whole idea. So this is our one image plane. So image plane of camera one. This is the image plane of camera two. They are distinguished by the primes. So here's O prime. And there's a point in the world, X. So we see this point in camera one at this position. So it's a lowercase x, yeah? same notation as before. But the problem is we don't know how far it is away. And so we know it's somewhere along that ray. Yeah? And we need the second camera picture to figure out, is it here, is it there, or is it there? But if we look at the projections of these points onto this camera, onto this image plane, it turns out these points all lie on one line. This is the so-called epipolar line. Yeah? So the epipolar constraint says, okay, if I'm looking for matching points for this x, then it has to, and I know the relation between the cameras, then it has to be located on that line. And if I don't find it there, what happens if I don't find it there? What happened if I don't find it there? Can this happen? No. Sorry?
That can't.
Can? Can't happen. Oh, I would say it can happen. But what's up if it happened?
It could be another point that we are seeing.
Oh, we are looking at many points. So there are, like, we have infinitely many points, but we look so hard for this x, but we don't find it along this plane. What happened?
Maybe it's hidden.
How could it be hidden? No, how? No.
It transferred from this direction.
Yeah, it could be occluded, right. I mean, there could be another object. Yeah? It could be that point, and maybe here's another object and occludes, like it occludes this point from this perspective. No? And this is actually a thing that can happen. Yeah, it's not unusual. No? So we have to be a little bit, we have to be a little bit tolerant in our search. No? Because in principle, things can also fail. But let's assume that that there's not, like, we don't have a very cluttered scene, so there's not much potential for occlusion. Then we can essentially always, minus many cases, find our correspondences also there. Yeah. Sorry. A question. Please.
Also be just out of the plane.
Oh yes, right. What if it's a very distant point? No, then it, we just leave the image plane and same situation. Yeah, so we don't find it again. Right. So there is always the possibility to not find your point, but we know if it is visible in this image, it's on that line. Yeah. Okay. And yeah, a little bit of vocabulary. So this line is the epipolar line. This is the other epipolar line. So it doesn't matter whether you go from this direction to that or from this to that. Okay. And this point here, where the baseline between the two cameras intersects the image planes, they are called epipoles. And it turns out all epipolar lines, so the epipolar lines of all points, all intersect in the epipole. Okay, and there are a couple of caveats. Like if we can have situations where we have parallel epipolar lines, so that means our epipoles lie at infinity. Yeah, okay. But these are the usual problems in geometry, no? Okay, if we do have the epipole in the image, we really see all the lines intersecting there. Okay. Ah, yeah. Sorry, the notation is here. Okay. So the baseline, epipoles, and epipolar plane is the whole thing. And where the epipolar plane intersects the image plane, we do have the epipolar line. Okay. And the epipolar line, sorry. Yeah, okay. Good. So here are some examples. So let's say we're looking for this point in the other picture. We know the calibration between the two cameras. That means we have to look along this line. We can readily compute this line. It's not any secret. We can also plot this line. This is what has been done here. Yeah. Okay. And then we only need to perform essentially a local search for a good matching feature and say, okay, this is a candidate for the match. Yeah. Or we can go the other way around, that we say we look for matching points in both images, and then say, okay, we only consider matches that lie on the epipolar line of the other image, and we discard all other matches as wrong matches. No? Okay, yeah. Motion parallel to, this is an interesting case. So what if we have a forward moving camera? So in this case, like if we move into the tunnel, sort of the points come towards us. And this is nicely seen. So we have a nice intersection here at this epipole. It's sort of also kind of a degenerate situation. So we have a two camera system where both cameras are behind each other. So essentially we have only one camera moving forward. Yeah. So we have picture one, picture two. And the feature points move outside along the epipolar lines. Okay, but these are already sort of very specific cases. Okay, so for what can we use this? There are different directions in which we can exploit this constraint. So one direction, certainly I already talked about it, is we can use it to find the x. So this is, we have an x observed here, and we're looking for the x prime in the other image. Right, we assume that we have all the calibration known and so on. And then we can restrict x prime to lie along L prime. Good. Here's another application. So it could be that we are just building this system, yeah? Or maybe we even have an unknown relationship between the pictures because we don't control the cameras. So then we could say we are looking for similar points, x and x prime, point pairs in the cameras, and we are trying to estimate from these pairs the relative position and orientation of the cameras, and then from that, the 3D position of the image points. So we sort of reverse engineer everything. Okay, and then, and this is a rather technical detail already. In order to have robust fitting methods, we also would like to have a mechanism like a crisp constraint to say, okay, if I have a correct projection between camera one and camera two, then candidate points X and X prime should actually be very close, like should be very close together when I solve for these equations. Yeah. So oftentimes when you implement an algorithm, a vision algorithm, then it's a two-step procedure where first you have a coarse estimate, like you have a couple of correspondences, and you're trying to get the alignment, for example, of the two cameras coarsely correct. Coarsely correct means like up to like plus minus one pixel or so. Yeah. Okay. So that means it's not so bad. It's actually a useful estimate already. But if you're trying to do measurements, for example, with these two cameras, then it's oftentimes not accurate enough. So you have a second step, where you say, okay, from this initial solution, I can actually run now, for example, an iterative refinement method or so to get subpixel accuracy of my camera alignment. And for this purpose, for example, it's also useful to have that constraint. Okay, so yeah, here's an example picture taken apparently from two different positions, two different photographs, and so on. And the epipolar lines estimated between them. And then example matches shown where these matches are constrained to lie on the epipolar lines between the two images. Yeah. And this gives these matches a very regular structure. If you don't apply this constraint, then you would have matches like all over the place. It would be a mess because you have here these bricks, this fine structure. So this creates all types of matches between the two images. Because large parts of the wall, they look as if they would have structure, but they, but all the structure is very similar, essentially. Okay.
Was that image already after the inline check?
Sorry?
Was that already after the inline check now? Because there's one that looks like an obvious mismatch, the yellow one.
That's actually true. How did this survive? This is a mismatch, yeah. This is wrong. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great remark. So we will talk at the end of the lecture, we will talk about what does it mean to be an inlier. And it could be that this line is just, you know, is close enough to the transform that we have between the two images. Like essentially to be like a boundary case. So, oh yeah, it's let's say it's an inlier. No? But when we look at it and we have all the other lines for comparison, then it's a little bit off, no? Apparently. Okay, so so intuitively everything is clear. So here are a couple of equations that constitute the epipolar constraint. Okay, so our 3D C point is shown in the picture as a point x hat. A point x. If we know the intrinsic calibration of the camera, we can sort of normalize the position of the point with respect to the intrinsic parameters and obtain a point x hat. So this is a homogeneous 2D point, so a 3D ray towards x, if you like. Okay, we can do the same thing for a point, world point x prime that we see in the second image. So this is an x prime for which we can also apply this normalization. So we normalize it by the intrinsic camera parameter and we obtain a point x prime hat. Now, if we say, okay, we believe we are looking at the same 3D object in the world, yeah, and we have a known calibration between the cameras, then we can actually say, okay, so these points should be identical. And then if we know the extrinsic and intrinsic parameters between the two cameras, then we can apply a rotation and a translation to the point x prime hat in order to map it onto the point x prime. Yeah, so this is what ties these two cameras together, or what links these two cameras, transformation from one point to the other point. So essentially, we take this ray and we rotate it and translate it such that it becomes that ray. Yeah, and then we have this mapping. So, and this is the transform that we will be using. Okay, now so this is the same mapping again. X hat equals a rotated X prime hat plus some translation. We can rewrite this. So an equivalent form of writing this is to write, we have an X hat times, so this is a scalar product, T, now a vector product, with the rotation times the X prime hat. And this shall be identical to zero. So what does this mean? So we have a rotation for the X prime hat. We rotate it. Now we have a translation vector that would shift it to the left. If we compute the vector product between the two, then we obtain a vector that is perpendicular on the epipolar plane. And then if we compute the scalar product to this vector X hat that is on the epipolar plane, it's zero, because the scalar product between two perpendicular vectors is zero. Yeah? And this is the epipolar constraint, but it's typically written a little bit differently. So it's typically written with a matrix E, that is the so-called essential matrix, and that covers this translation and rotation. Okay, yeah, right. E is, now here we have a special matrix T, which is essentially a matrix representation of the vector product times the rotation matrix. So what is this matrix representation of the vector product? Sorry, I wrote this down. It's equation 2.32 in the book. So we have some vector in these squared brackets, and then a subscript, like a vector product operator. And this is the matrix 0, minus T C, in this case TX, sorry, TY, TC 0, this is now minus TX, and this is minus TY TX 0. Okay. So essentially, when you multiply this matrix, so if you look at the permutation of the entries of the vector, so T is TX, TY, TZ, of course. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense, sorry. So when you look at the permutation of these entries, then I think it becomes clear if you're multiplying this matrix, for example, to another vector, then these entries are evaluated in an order that you would also use when you would compute directly some vector product, for example, on two vectors. Yeah? Okay. So and technically it allows us to isolate these two, like the vector operator, the T and the R, in one matrix. Yeah, so it's like a technical tool. Okay, this is the essential matrix. So E is a 3x3 matrix. It relates corresponding pairs of normalized homogeneous image points across pairs of images. For calibrated cameras. Hmm? Okay. Now, how can we compute our quantities? For example, the epipolar line L that we have here in that picture is obtained by calculating essential matrix times X prime. The other epipolar line, so L prime, in the other picture is obtained by calculating E transpose X. So then we get from the left image to the right image. essential matrix times epipole equals zero. The essential matrix has rank 2 only, and it has 5 degrees of freedom. Okay, good. So this is all nice and good, but the problem is, or one assumption that is a little bit inconvenient in practice, is that we know the intrinsic calibration of the two cameras. And oftentimes we don't. Yeah? If we start to download images from Flickr of the Colosseum in Rome, for example, we have no idea what the intrinsic calibration is. And to address this, there's a modified version of the essential matrix. It's called the fundamental matrix that includes the camera calibration, so we don't need to know it in advance. So the fundamental matrix, the letter that is typically used for it is F. All our constraints remain the same. So we have also our epipolar constraint as X transpose F X prime equals zero. The only difference is that F contains the inverse of, the transposed inverse of the calibration matrix of the left camera and the inverse of the calibration matrix of the right camera around the essential matrix, which is readily obtained if we just plug in these values and group the matrices in the middle. So this is the fundamental matrix that is, I think, in most cases estimated or in, yeah, okay. Yeah, so all constraints remain the same. Fx prime equals zero. It's the epipolar line with Ftx equals zero is the epipolar line L prime, and so on and so on. So this is really the same slide as what we just looked at before for the essential matrix, just that we don't need to know the calibration for this case. Oh, sorry, there's one difference. F has not 5, but 7 degrees of freedom. So, yeah. Good, so let's have a look at the fundamental matrix in greater detail. So it's a 3x3 matrix. It only has rank 2 because one column is a linear combination of the other two. It's determined up to scale. So that is what we have to sacrifice if we don't know the camera calibration. and it has 7 degrees of freedom. And it's written like this. So here we have A, B, C, D, E, and F. And then we have alpha A plus beta B. So we have the terms alpha and beta here. So these are eight variables, but one of them can typically be set by definition to something because we don't know really the scale. So let's say we set A to a specific value, then we have 7 degrees of freedom left. Okay. Now, given two images, a couple of correspondences in these images, how can we estimate the fundamental matrix? And we can say, well, let's not make a big deal. No? We have our equation, so x transpose fx equals 0. We can just, we know we have these 7 unknowns, so we can set up a linear system of equations. Insert the coordinates of our correspondences and solve that. Yeah? For example, compute a least square solution. You can use singular value composition for this task. We require 8 pairs of correspondences, but if our image is a little bit cooperative, we probably find them and then we're good. We should enforce the rank 2 to reduce noise in our estimate, and then we're good. Yeah? Okay. So how do we... that's actually a good question. How can we enforce... So what does this line mean? Enforce determinant F equals 0 constraint using SVD on F. So we know the target rank of our matrix is 2. What can we do? What can we do? What options do we have? What can we do? Yes. So the singular value decomposition factorizes the matrix into we have our basis vectors, but we also have our singular values. Yeah. And if we have a rank 2 matrix, if we decompose a 3x3 matrix, but if it's only rank 2, that means that the third singular value, the smallest singular value, it should be identical to 0. So if we are computing the SVD anyways, we can look at the smallest entry, and if it's not 0, then we can conclude, well, this must be due to some noise in our data or so, so we just set it to 0. And multiply the matrices together again, and have our result. It's a very common approach, actually, to enforce a lower rank of a matrix. Okay. Oh yeah. Here's an interesting note. If you only have 2 images. And you're looking at a planar scene, then hell breaks loose. So we're not talking about ways how to solve it, but essentially you need a third view to get rid of this specific case. Okay. Good. Okay, so more in detail, very quickly. We said we are solving a system of homogeneous linear equations. That means we set up our our linear systems of equations based on the epipolar constraint. Then we can sort of fill in all the variables by tearing these matrices apart and sort them by the coordinates, the matching coordinates that we have in the vectors x and x prime, and the entries of the fundamental matrix, and require this to be zero. So then this is really a standard like least square solution, and compute it. Okay, so yeah, and here are three lines of MATLAB to do this. Okay, to apply the SVD. Okay, now here's a demo of the noise to expect, and why we should enforce the rank 2 constraint. So here is the fundamental matrix just estimated with the least squares fit, and the epipolar lines are added, but the rank 2 constraint is not enforced. And what we can observe here is that the epipolar lines do not all meet in the epipole. So yeah, epipolar lines are not coincident. Now, if we enforce the rank 2 constraint, we essentially are forcing all the epipolar lines to meet in the epipoles. Okay. Yeah, so the enforcing the rank 2 constraint here is just, as we said, done by setting the third singular value to 0. Okay. Now, the 8-point algorithm is actually pretty old, and it had, for a while, it had a bad reputation because it's numerically not very stable. So the reason for this is that when you look at the data matrix, these entries can have very different sizes, and then we can run into numerical instabilities. Yeah? And then there was a very famous paper written by Hartley. The title was, I think, In Defense of the 8-Point Algorithm. Yeah, we can look it up later, doesn't matter. And there he said, yeah, okay, so actually the 8-point algorithm does work, no? It's pretty good, but we have to take care of our range of values. So we have to apply a proper scaling of the data, and then it works just fine. So this paper, it really had a big impact. And it's probably the most well-known paper by Hartley, 1995, right? So the normalization, these are actually quite simple steps all. So center the image data at the origin, okay? Scale it so that the mean squared distance between origin and data points is 2 pixels, which is like a magic number, but okay. so we shrink it a little bit. Then we use the 8-point algorithm that we just looked at, so this couple of lines of SVD execution. We enforce our rank 2 constraint. And then we have to transform the solution back into the original, like, scaling, no? Otherwise, of course, it doesn't make sense. And that's it. So that actually, and of course, he also attached, argumentation why this is actually reasonable and so on in that paper. But that really solved these numerical issues with the 8-point algorithm and made it to the tool that is, well, now like the standard tool to solve this task. Okay. Still, if you like to have very accurate solution, then you can say, okay, I start with the 8-point algorithm, and then I compute the fundamental matrix, and then I apply another sort of subpixel refiner to further improve my solution beyond what that least squares solution can provide. Okay, but we're not going further into this. Okay, yeah, so here, just to give you an impression of the magnitudes that we are talking. So if we are evaluating the reprojection error across two images, so that means we take one point in one image with cameras with known calibration, we estimate the calibration of these cameras, and then say, okay, if this is the correct calibration, then we can actually take this point and project it into the scene and sort of back into the other camera and see where it ends up being. Yeah, and we can measure the pixel distance to the true location of the reprojected point. Okay, so this means we get a pixel error here. And like in this arguably synthetic example, we have with the 8-point algorithm, we have an average pixel error of 2-point-something pixels. So we are like 2 pixels off approximately. Normalized 8-point algorithm gives a subpixel accuracy already. So we have an average error of 0.9, let's say, pixels. And then with further refinement, for example, by nonlinear least squares, you can get down to 0.8 something, no? Now in this example. So just to give you an idea about like a rough ballpark about the accuracy of the algorithms. Okay. Good, yeah, I mean, yeah, if we know the calibration matrices of the two cameras, then we can estimate the essential matrix. And the essential matrix gives the relative rotation and translation between the cameras. You could say these are the extrinsic parameters. The fundamental matrix sort of mixes this all together. So we have the unknown intrinsic calibration included in these matrices. So we can say this is similar to a calibration between the two cameras, but because we have this mixture of the intrinsic and extrinsic parameters in one thing, then people sometimes like to say, okay, this is like a weak calibration between the two cameras. Okay, the fundamental matrix song. So that's actually a nice thing. Probably you know it already, but it doesn't matter. It's always worth watching. Let me crank up the volume as far as possible. Sorry, I did not really bring equipment here, suitable equipment, but okay, let's see. You can watch it at home as well. And there's also the text. The text is actually summarizes everything I said in a nicer form. Can I make this full screen? And you'll see two points that correspond.
set of points, your sample set will be degenerate. That will not bring you joy. Wait till with the estimation, turn the four great generation, your every color lies, and the angles will not coincide. But if your scene has three views, we try for the chances, but you use constraints from the third view, act like blue.
Yeah, so this is a really nice video. I didn't look at the YouTube statistics. Actually, we could. It's sort of, it's shown in every computer vision class. So it, fundamental matrix song. No. Ah, yeah. And you see, there are not so many people in your field, 90,000 views. Recently, I saw like a pop song with a billion views. Né? I was like, a billion? Okay, so 90,000. Yeah, okay, 90,000 is also not so bad, right? Okay. Okay. So much to the essential matrix and the fundamental matrix. Now, another tool that helps to do model selection and model fitting is the Ransack algorithm. And this relates, if you remember the original question, so let's say we like to build a stereo system. We now have the epipolar constraint to limit our search space for corresponding matches to narrow it down to a single line. But still, that is a nice constraint, but still we need some tool to determine a robust fit because we potentially still have a lot of wrong matches. So just in order to get an initial solution, we need to have something robust. And the Ransack algorithm is maybe the most popular tool or so for this. At least certainly the most basic tool. Okay, very quick recap. So least squares algorithm is not really robust to noise. If we have large outliers, so here we have an example fit. Here we add just one outlier, but actually it's a really bad outlier. Anyways, so if we then make a least squares fit, then our line can be just wrong, yeah, and we need something that is a little bit more robust. Here's one alternative. It's called robust least squares. It's essentially a patch to the least squares algorithm where we say, okay, we don't really use this quadratic penalty term because this really grows too fast for outliers that are far out. But instead, we use a function that caps the error at a certain distance. So the error flattens out, and we only reduce the error if we are close to the actual solution. Yeah. So we can do a fit. We can use a distance function like this, and it's certainly much more robust to these very large outliers. Yeah, the problem is that the optimization becomes more difficult, of course, when we use such a function instead of just the least squares. Yeah. So one challenge certainly is that we have to find the right scale or the right width of the function to work well with our data. So the scale parameter sigma has to be chosen, and here's just an example. So if we get the scale right, then indeed it can be a quite robust fitting procedure. If the scale is too small, it can be, or too large, then we just can get very nonsensical results too. Okay. So the and fitting such a function is a nonlinear optimization problem. So we need an iterative solution in order to get that. We still have to choose the scaling. So it also doesn't come for free. What people oftentimes do again is a multi-step procedure, no? That we say, okay, let's somehow get close to the actual solution. For example, let's start with a least square solution. It's not going to be so bad. Maybe it will be just a little bit wrong, no? And then refine that solution with a robust function. And there, probably the scale is easier to adapt because we make an assumption on how close we got already with the least square solution, for example. Okay. So the least squares fit and the robust least squares could be seen as instances of global optimization methods. And particularly for many computer vision problems, people also like to use another family of optimization methods that is here called hypothesize and test. So for some problems, the Huff transform is used. The Huff transform, did we talk about the Huff transform? But you're probably familiar with it, right? Are you? Who heard about the Huff transform already? This is not overwhelming. Oh, sorry. Okay. Actually, I dropped the slides on the Huff transform because I thought this would be known stuff. So Huff transform is a brute force search for the parameters, like for a parametric model for the data. For example, consider you perform a line fit. Consider you perform a line fit. You have a couple of points. You like to fit a line. Then you say, okay, what is the parametric model of my line? I can say, so let me do it really naively. So it's mx plus t. Yeah, we wouldn't use this function. We would use a function that also allows vertical lines in practice, but it doesn't matter. Yeah, okay, mx plus t. So the parameters are m and rt. So this means we can say, okay, what are the possible values for m? What are the possible values for t? And then start to look at, for example, if you're fitting a line. We look at one point and say, okay, if this point is part of the line, then the line can be either in this orientation or in this orientation or in this orientation. Okay, you see, there are a lot of possibilities, right? So we add a check mark for each of these possibilities here in this coordinate system. Yeah, m is the slope. Slope can be negative, I don't know, we start somewhere, minus 100, minus 99, and so on, 0, 99, 100, yeah. T is the offset. Let's say we are also considering values between minus 100 and plus 100. I'm really inventing things here. You have to make a decision. And now if you enter these values here, So if we linearly change the slope, we obtain a structure that looks like this. Yeah, but it doesn't really matter. So we enter, like we have a dense grid here, yeah. And we add one point for every set of parameters that we could possibly obtain if this point would be part of a line. Yeah, so it could be this, 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 and so on. Okay, then we look at the next point, yeah, and do the very same thing. Now we are at a different position, so what lines can be thought? This line, this line, this line, actually also going through this point, yeah? So maybe we obtain a second curve here in half space that looks like this, okay, where we have an intersection here. So here we have a 2, because we have 2 points voting for these line parameters. And in all other cells, we have a 1, because so far we only had 1 point advocating this parametrization. Do we have a second intersection? It doesn't really make sense, right? So maybe should make this mathematically a little bit cleaner. But anyways, so and that way you go through all the lines, yeah, and you accumulate, you build up a histogram of possible line parameters, yeah. And let's say this line, I have no idea. Maybe we end up having here a point where many of these, where many votes come together. So here we have a maximum, a local or global or local maximum in our parameters. So we say, oh, okay, this M with this T, this must be a line. Yeah. We have all types of problems. We have computational problems, because you can imagine this will not be cheap. Yeah, you go through a tableau with as many dimensions as you have unknown parameters, and you do it as often as you have points in your scene. Yeah, so this will be expensive. The next question is, how fine do you discretize your space? No? Because if you only coarsely discretize your space, then also your solution will be coarse. No? Let's imagine you go here in steps of 10, for example. No? Then your line will not be very accurate. No? And so on. So these are a couple of problems that you have to solve. On the other hand, there's not much more that you have to do. Yeah? So it's really a brute force search for suitable parameters for the data. So this is the half transform. Okay. Good. And last, what I would like to talk about is the Rancic algorithm. I think so Rancic, Rancic also hypothesizes on the variance, but it does it a little bit more directly than the half transform, maybe. So first of all, Rancic stands for random sample consensus. So that means you draw a couple of random samples, you fit a model to them, and then you see whether this model leads to some consensus or so on your remaining data. As you can see, it's from 1981, so it's probably older than you are. Okay, so you have a couple of points. and you like to fit a line to these points, yeah? but at the same time, okay, of course you do have all these outliers there, so if you look at all the points at the same time, it may be very easily very confusing for your fitting procedure. So instead, the approach is that we only sample S points, yeah? For fitting a line, in principle, 2 points would suffice, yeah? So we can pick 2 points, compute the model parameters, for example, the M and the T, and then we see how many of the actual points in the scene agree to our model within certain bounds. So this within certain bounds, I think we saw this already when we looked at this one line that was a little bit off. So this was apparently still within the bounds. Yeah. Okay. And then, so maybe we were just unlucky with these 2 points. Yeah. So there's no guarantee that we pick 2 good points here, like 2 inlier points. So that means we iterate this 100 times or 10,000 times or so, to make sure that, that we have a really good probability to get some inliers at the end of the day. Yeah. So it's also not 100% cheap, but in many cases, it's cheaper than the Huff transform in terms of computational complexity. Okay. So here we pick 2 lines to fit, 2 points to fit a line, fit our line, and then check, okay, which other points would support this as a line. Yeah, so that means how many other points are within a certain margin. And we see, okay, 4 other points would fit this model. So we can write down, if we have a line with these parameters, we have 6 inliers. So this is our current best solution that we have. And then we iterate. And if, once we get a better solution, okay, like this, with 14 inliers, then we store this as our preferred solution. Okay. Yeah, so for the application of RANSAC, we also have to make a number of parameter decisions. So one is, how often do we iterate the algorithm? Yeah, so the number of iterations n. I think it makes sense. We can only fit a good model if our random draw gives us 2 inliers to the true model. Yeah, that is what we need. So the problem is we don't, like oftentimes we only have a coarse noise estimate or so on the data. So it's tough in practice to analytically compute this probability unless you have really a solid control over your imaging system. Yeah. So in which situations do you have control over your imaging system? Well, think of industrial applications or oftentimes also medical applications, like where you build the device, you control the illumination, the scene, and so on. In these cases, you might be in a situation where you can actually compute that probability. In other situations, maybe you can't, and then you just say, oh, I repeat it a number of times, and I do a couple of checks how well it works on average. Yeah. Sorry, you had a question.
For the first RANSAC, we select a line. So how can we select that? So it means we choose random 2 points.
Mm-hmm.
And so create a line or have a random
line. No. No, you select 2 points. This is actually important. So you take actual measurements. From a statistical perspective, this is actually important. So you take actual measurements because that's the best thing that you have. Yeah. So you take actual measurements, but you don't know whether, I mean, since you have randomly chosen them, you have no idea whether this was a good pick. No? So, and that is where the outlier counting, the inlier counting comes in. Okay, yeah, then the number of sample points, so the minimum number needed to fit the model, okay? That certainly also depends on the model. And then the distance threshold, so what do you still accept as an inlier to fit the model? No, that again depends on your noise model and your knowledge of the noise model, of course, depends really heavily on what constraints you or what prior knowledge you have on your application, of course. No? Okay. Good. So Yeah, so here's an example estimating the translation using RANSEC. Given matched points A in set A and set B, so picture one and picture two, estimate the translation of the object. And certainly our matches can be, like we can have wrong matches there. So we exactly have this type of outlier suppression problem. Okay, so we sample a pair of points, compute the transformation, and then we count how many other points fit to that. Okay, good. And we have no solution. Sorry for this. Okay, but here, coming back to the cathedral, when you look at the matches, if you don't apply any constraints, when you look at the matches, you see it's a real mess. Yeah. So you somehow need to obtain an initial estimate in order to be able to compute the fundamental matrix, or if you know the intrinsic calibration, even the essential matrix. Yeah. Okay. So you pick. So how many correspondences do we need to compute a fundamental matrix? These were 8 correspondences, right? Like 8 matched pairs. Okay, so we randomly choose 8 matched pairs. You can see we certainly need to compute this a couple of times because there's noise. and then see how many of the matched pairs fit to our estimated fundamental matrix. Yeah. Okay. And that again then gives the epipolar lines, and again we have our filter with our slightly misaligned line here. Sorry for that. Okay. No? But it really helps to clean up this, like to take out so many of these false matches that can occur in practical applications. Okay, so that's it. Some last words about RANSEC. So it's certainly a super popular strategy to deal with a number of outliers in the matches. Can also be used for a large number of function parameters. So this is something where the Huff transform quickly gets out of hand. So if this is a d-dimensional space over which you are brute forcing, it's too expensive. And it's a little bit easier to set up than the Huff transform. And that's certainly part of the popularity of the RANSEC. Okay, on the other hand, it's also not cheap. So you also have to repeat this really a lot of times in many scenarios. And it's not good if you like to have a list of candidates, yeah, like a serious question, what are the 5 best fits or so, then it's tough to impose additional constraints, yeah, for example, the 5 best fits, but they should be a little bit different from each other. No, this is, in the Huff transform, it's easy, yeah. You can say, okay, if this is my best match, then I want that my next best match is significantly different from that. So this means if I make this decision that this is the best match, so I can just declare this a dead zone, yeah? So no other best matches from this area, please. Yeah? Okay, no problem. And then maybe my next best match is here. And this is certainly a line that is quite different from this line or so. Yeah? We cannot, it's ugly to try to implement something like this in the RANSEC. No? Okay. And yeah, okay. So you can use this to estimate the fundamental matrix or to compute a homography, so a planar mapping between 2 views. These are the typical applications. Okay. Good. So next week, or from next week on, Mark Stamminger will take over and he'll go to the more higher level vision tasks, let's say. Did we talk about exams already? Probably not so much, or at least I don't really remember. So we will, we will have oral exams, and we will make these appointments in, I would say, approximately like the last 2 weeks of the lecture, something like this. Yeah, because like all of you have a lot of exams. I will also have a lot of exams. And so such that we know better, like we already know a couple maybe of your dates also, such that we don't need to reallocate this all the time, because this is what actually creates a lot of overhead to us always. Yeah. Okay. And then there will be a selection of dates available. So don't be concerned or so that we don't find a solution for your specific case or so. This will be oral exams, yeah? So that means we will have a conversation about these topics. But conversation doesn't mean that it shouldn't become technical or so, no? So like, for example, what you saw in this video, this guy drawing this constraint, so that would certainly be an expectation that I would have, like, if you should be able to write down like the core equations and to explain them, yeah. Sorry. You can sing it also. That would be probably weird, but you can do it. Yeah. Yeah, it's okay. There are some maybe. So if you do have trouble registering in Mein Campus for the exam, then don't worry. Just make an appointment with us, and we can always, like, you can always get a physical paper certificate for the exam. Yeah, and then see how you can use it. Yeah, okay. Good. I think that's it from my side. So, yeah. Then see you then. No?